This is Sander Roscoe Wolf, culture agent columnist with LBPost.com, and I'm here speaking with...
Dave Wakeling of the English Beat at your service, is what I would say.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. You're playing in Long Beach quite soon. This is your second show here.
We really enjoyed the first one, so we're really glad to come back. There's a very positive and music and audience oriented vibe about the place. Now, often that comes about places when they're starting up and finding their feet, but it seems to be a really nice vibe there. And it's been on and off really over the years that we've had a really nice room, nice people to play in Long Beach, and so I'm really glad to be a part of the development of this club. I think it's fantastic.
Great. So I was going to ask you a bit about the challenge of presenting material that's almost going on 30 years old now. I know that as a songwriter, you must be engaged in what's going on. Back in the day, a lot of your work was political and social. Are there things that you're tackling now that...
record about 20 of them, but a sort of hiatus has been put on it because they're just about to release a box set of the English Beat, and so we've kept the set these last couple of months into these next couple of months, mainly focusing on that, not wanting to mix apples and oranges, and especially you've got the original members of the band back in England from the recordings, and nobody wanted to do anything that looked like it was, you know, slipstreaming or showboating. But, yeah, there are new interests politically. It's more or less the same. And luckily, quite a lot of the lyrics from those original albums have become peculiarly appropriate again. So the song Cheated on... the second record, Whoppin', was written about Rupert Murdoch in 1982, called Cheated. and had all sorts of literary jokes in there. We are oppressed into association, all sorts of things. It's in our water and our education. But it was about Rupert Murdoch and his coarsening of British newspaper culture with The Sun and papers like that, that would be extremely divisive and sarcastic and sort of make political gain and power and profit in the way they set people against each other. And he bought the Sunday Times or the London Times in that year. And so I wrote a line, young swingers in these sundialing times sweeping the nation, the dance called the Breadline. And I was thrilled at the end of the year, Elvis Costello picked his Lyric of the Year in a music magazine, the annual Christmas Roundup edition. And so I've been giggling about that this week because Rupert Murdoch's back in the news, should we say, for exactly what I was whining about in 1982. Divisive coarsening of debate. And another song called I'm Your Flame, it's on the same record, says, I ran into Northern Ireland, ran into Afghanistan, dying to become a man. I am your flag. So I'm thinking of changing my name to Scostradamus.
Well,
something's going on here. But I think all it is really there are universal themes in there. Those sorts of things hardly change. But a different way of expressing it now. I have a nice new song, which is a sort of big, bombastic rock song in the tradition of The Clash, or the closest I could ever get, called If Killing Worked, It Would Have Worked By Now. And I'm just getting to that age where you don't have to mince your words nowadays. It's like, look, you're killing each other's children for the last 30 years, haven't sorted this out. Guess what? Pack it in.
Well, you were never really known for mincing words, actually. I mean, I think you've been doing that all along, don't you think? I mean, you've been pretty like you said, pretty willing to call people out.
I think it just boils down, you know. So rather than it being particular situations, it just becomes more a universal feeling that you can. You know, I wasn't able to express it as simply as that. Although I must say, I knew that ever since I was a kid. But, you know, killing people don't work. Or there may be much more cost-effective alternatives, one wonders. But I don't mind singing the songs because they've become part of my tapestry and part of the tapestry of people in the audience, and that they say lovely things about what certain lyrics have meant to them over the years, or what situations they used the songs or applied the lyrics to. And to me, that's kind of priceless. It's you're sitting in the corner writing them by yourself, not really expecting anybody to ever read them except yourself. So for 30 years later, for them to come and say thank you and call you Mr. Wakeland, which is very odd. That's very heartwarming, I must say. But I am anxious to get some of the new stuff up and going as soon as these new box sets and best ofs and retrospectives and bus festival live DVD and all of that. Once that's up and established, then I would love to start bringing out some of my new pennings.
Do you think that the business of music has changed to the point where it's actually difficult now to, if you're not like touring or gigging endlessly, to make a living at it?
Well, I don't. In as much as you can't rely upon the notion of record company sponsorship through the early years of your recording career, because that doesn't exist to anything like the same degree it used to, and there's good and bad about that. I think what you might find is more and more people making a decent living at doing music and being very popular and very successful within their own small genre, like me with Scar, for example, or something like that, because there isn't the massive hammer of mass marketing available to most artists now. And you did wonder about it at the time, but to be honest, because you could do a concert and, you know, quite a lot of the fans might be teenagers and they all got the album for you to sign. And you wondered, you know, gosh, I hope these people didn't feel pressured into buying this because they'd be the only kid in class who didn't have it. And I wonder how many of them will be there for the next one. So you can make massive sales with mass marketing, but I don't know whether you necessarily make lifetime connections that end up being emotionally more satisfying, and probably in the long run even financially more satisfying, because if somebody really likes your stuff for the right reasons, they'll probably buy the other ones too.
Right. I totally see what you mean. So do you feel like your success is independent of the back catalog? Do you think you can sort of put that aside? And
oh, no, I wouldn't have thought so. And I think that particularly in America, there's a special place in the market for legacy artists, which is what I've become now. I think the problem for me is more likely that people might like the old songs so much that they don't want to hear any new ones anyway. However, we've done a few. We put five or six in the set and they've gone down. Some people have been frustrated that we haven't brought them out as records yet. So I think we're in with a chance. You've just got to be sensitive about it and judicious. I do hate it when an artist I've liked for years or decades comes and does a show and doesn't play any of the hits. I'm like, you're lucky you have the hits, mate, to be nobody here otherwise. So it's a balance. I enjoy playing them now. We've got it down to a fine art. We've got some nice backing vocals. We've got some flashy, without being pompous, arrangements that have just sort of evolved when somebody did a clever bit, and so we did it again the next night. And and the audience seem to enjoy it. They're close enough to the originals to be appropriate for strolling down memory lane, but they're in the moment enough to be like a really good group would be playing them in Long Beach in 2012, which is fortunate because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I also was curious, by the way, how you felt about the resurgence a few years back of ska influence in bands like Sublime and No Doubt, who clearly credit you and the other sort of ska influenced bands from England from the 80s.
They've always been very decent in their credits on us as well, and that's always to be appreciated. I mean, it's a thrill that anybody would be influenced by your music and then, you know, put their mark on it and make it their own. Like, nobody would confuse No Doubt Sublime and the English Beat, but it's an honour to think that we got them jazzed to look for their own groove in that direction. And both of them did a very good job, I think, in helping to draw all kind of different people together. The underlying sense of unity, I thought, was very effectively done. So, yeah, that's another great bit of having a catalogue, is that you actually influence people like your heroes or your mentors that inspired you.
So let's actually go back to that. When you were a young lad growing up, how did you get connected to that whole ska thing?
Well, there were a lot of Jamaican immigrants in the Midlands of Birmingham. I grew up with us, and the skinheads of the late 60s, early 70s had formed a pretty good alliance with Rude Boys, Jamaican teenagers, who'd been born in England. So a first generation of Jim English teenagers. And so the music had permeated quite a lot through teen culture, especially on the skinhead and mods side of things, and all the way through the soccer field, soccer stadium side of things, where a lot of ska was played for the skinheads on the bleachers before the game and in the half time and at the end of the game to keep them quiet and try and get them to not nut each other on the bridge of the nose with their forehead. So it was fortuitous, really, I suppose, a good accident. And it was just immediately intoxicating to me, the beat. From a distance, it sounds happy. That's the first thing. It's upbeat, and so it sounds happy, and it sounds optimistic. And then the deeper you get into it, and the more you study the lyrics of it, feel the influences of it, you realise that that happiness is really because it's a music of survival. It's sometimes a music you'd have instead of dinner, instead of after dinner. And so there's a kind of nobility about it that translates, whilst it's bubbled right up to the top, as an ebullience, an optimism, a happiness, a joie de vivre, or something like that. But it's actually, I think, much more substantial than just that. It's not just, ha ha ha, let's have a good time. It's sharing the common joy and common bond of suffering that we all inherit as human beings.
Yeah, and that actually is found throughout a lot of traditional African music and North African music and cultures all over the world, actually.
And there's a sort of similarity in the way Old English or Scottish or Irish music, they tend to have a lot of laments, don't they? They just sing your sadness out round and round. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear me. Sing round and round and round after about an hour of that. That's kind of our version of the blues, you know, and you feel better after you've had a good wine.
So there's a British tradition of whining, then?
Well, it's not on the happy side of things, no, more in the laments, you know. That's Celtic, particularly.
I see.
Sad songs that make you feel happy by the time you finish the last chorus. It sounds like catharsis or something. But I liked this reggae piece And I also liked other types of music too. I liked Van Morrison, and I liked Tim Buckley, and I liked Captain Beefheart, and I liked the Velvet Underground. And the Beat, in some ways, was an experiment at trying to hybrid Toots and the Maytals, the Velvet Underground, the Four Tops and the Buzzcocks and the Monkees.
Well, that's a pretty intoxicating mix right there.
Heady.
Yeah.
So, but to try and get that sort of uplift from Toots and the Maytals, the insistence, almost manic insistence of the Velvet Underground, the emotional connection and the Four Tops and the Monkees and the Buzzcocks, both really because of that classic format of having a song less than 3 minutes, but everybody singing the chorus as the song fades out and wants to put the record back on. So that was the idea.
When did you figure out that this formula, this mixture that you had concocted, was actually going to do something big?
Well, it started sitting on the floor of a house party where we lived with me and Andy, the other guitarist, Andy Cox. And we had two DJs at these parties, one playing punk singles, 7-inch vinyl, red or yellow vinyl, neon vinyl, and one playing 12-inch dub slates with thick pieces of vinyl used as a tea tray. And we found if you've got a nice combination of those going on, the dance floor would stay packed all night. But if you played a bit too much punk, the party would go fizzing like a bottle of champagne, and then everybody would have to go and have a rest somewhere. And if you had too much reggae in a row, people would end up leaning against the walls and just nodding. And the combination of the two, just the excitement versus this seductive, sort of hypnotic backbeat, it seemed to just make people feel really joyful. And Andy said to me, yes, but what if you could get the elements of both DJs into the same 3-minute pop single? Then what would you have? And I was like, whoa. You'd have a great party every time you put the needle on the record. So that was the start of it. And so our early experiments were tricky, trying to find where all of our different influences could meet, like spheres, and where you could make a perfect circle out of them in the middle. It would hold for a little while, then we'd all branch off into our own vibes, and it'd get all messy again, and it would come back in. Oh, look, just like that, just hold it right there, just like that, don't move. And we're still like not quite certain where we were getting with things, and then people would come round the rehearsal and go, wow, that sounds really great, doesn't it? We go, oh, does it? Right, let's do that one again, just like that. And it slowly evolved up, you know.
Right. So, but when did you actually figure out that it was something huge, though? I mean, there must have been a moment when you realized it wasn't a dance floor in somebody's house. It was you were playing larger and larger venues, and more people were dancing for longer and longer.
Quickly. Well, that came very quickly. In some ways, some of us discussed afterwards, it might have come too quickly. We weren't ready for it when it is. But our first show was in March '79. The same weekend as the Three Mile Island nuclear incident, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And by Christmas, we were number six in the charts with a single on Two Tone Records that was all the rage at the time, and every major record company falling over themselves to increase their offers above what they thought the other ones might be thinking of offering us. And so we ended up with our own little record label, like Specials did. Theirs was called Two Tone, and we named ours Go Feet. And with the basic idea that when you're dancing, your mind's more open to ideas. That's what I'd found. When you're dancing, you listen to a song, the lyrics become 3D. You get all the nuances and the inferences and what the singer or the writer means above and beyond the words. You get to actually dance to the lines between the words. And so we always wanted that to be a part of our, even if it was a ballad, it was a swaying ballad.
And the scene at that time, because there were a number of other bands that were, like you mentioned, that were doing kind of a similar sort of thing. Were you all mates? Was there a sense of competition amongst you? Or how did that...
It was very odd. We'd been at it a few months and then saw something in the newspapers. This band called Specials in Coventry, only 17 miles down the road, were mixing punk and ska. And for a minute we were like, oh, no. But we thought we had a wider brief than them anyway, and we thought, well, we might as well carry on, you never know. And if they're no good, it won't matter. And if they are good, it'll be somebody else that maybe there's a scene developing here, like we're feeling around the gigs we've started to play. So, as luck would have it, the leader of the Specials came down to see us playing on a Tuesday night. We had a Tuesday residency, more and more people were coming every Tuesday, and the time he arrived, I think it was about our sixth or eighth show. We only managed to do 12 because he got silly in the end. There was just more people outside than in, and he asked us to open for the Selector. We did that, and we met the Specials, and then he said, oh, there's a gig in London for the Selector, do you want to open for them there? And we did, and we met Madness, and it just blew up. At the time, of course, part of us thought, well, we always kind of knew we were wonderful, bright young things. This was just a matter of time until this happened. But in retrospect, we were terribly lucky, and we did tease our friends. Our friends teased us back, you know. All of a sudden, 6 months later, you go into a pub, and people would say, all right, Elvis, you're around.
do you see the evolution of ska in Jamaica as affecting popular music now?
You mean ska in Jamaica now, or ska in Jamaica in the '60s?
Now,
seeing through the culture till now.
Well, both. That's either one.
The dance hall of Jamaica, prominent style, doesn't seem to bear much of the relevance or connection to that ska. It's a little bit more like American rap, I think, in its attitude, and you know, that can be for better or worse. There's still a playful side to it, but I think more to your question, when we first got here, nobody was really used to reggae, and nobody even quite kind of knew how to dance to it. And now you hear something with a reggae offbeat in like one out of every five TV commercials, especially if it's something for kids or young or fun or anything like that. The sort of circusy vibe to it has become quite a common musical thing in America now. So I think you have to think about things like that in terms of generational change, much like you do about people's attitudes about social situations, you know, colour, sexuality, any of that.
Right. Well, I have to say that I'm really excited about you coming back to Long Beach, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but thank you so much, really, truly, for speaking with me. And
my pleasure. An interesting different set of questions, too, you know. A little bit too much on the memory lane thing, perhaps. I mean, I don't want people to be put off thinking that that's all it is. It's a great contemporary night out, and some of the times... the greatest compliment I ever get at a show from some drunk guy is like, you guys are great. You should make a record. I got a buddy that makes records. You want to, I'll get his card for you. And it's like, oh, the one thing you could think, oh my God, I've been trying 30 years and never got through to him, you know. But on the other side, you're like, wow, he doesn't even know we've got records out, but he thought it was a great show, so we're a good band. So in some ways, that's an even better compliment.
Well, I mean, but also just I think this is important to say, is that the reason why people continue to love your music and continue to support you as an artist and all of that is because the songs are great. They're great, great songs. And
you know, you get to pick your best 2 hours worth of material garnered over a 30-year period, and you can also use that 30 years to practice them, to get them right. So, so it puts you in quite a lucky position in some ways. Right. We've done about over 1,000 shows, me, the drummer and the bass player, in the last 7 years. And so we've definitely got a connection with him to try and make the song be the important thing. We just try and play as little as possible that would just make the song take wings and fly out and hover above the crowd.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, sir. I really do appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing you when you're here.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for the interview. I'll see you over there.
All right. Bye-bye.